This podcast is by G. Wayne Miller for the Providence Journal.
Eight, almost nine, and I started peddling drugs.
Where was this, Anton?
Taunton, Massachusetts, Fairfax Gardens, better known to most people as D-Wirt.
So you started peddling drugs, selling them. What kind of drugs?
Cocaine, crack cocaine.
When did you start using drugs?
My friends kind of tricked me into it because I used to not really mess with it. I didn't even take my medication I was given. Like, I didn't like anything like that. And I was a big fan of the Flintstones chewables. My first run-in with drugs, my friends gave me an ecstasy tablet that was shaped like Fred Flintstone. So I was under the impression I was taking a Flintstone vitamin. Until about an hour later when I couldn't keep my hands off myself. And then from there, went to marijuana, acid, and really the hard drugs came from selling drugs. I was probably about 12, 13 years old when I was going to pick up a big order from my uncle. And the guy that was selling to my uncle, I was going to pick the order up from, wanted me to do the cocaine before I left in order to prove I wasn't a police. Like, guy, I'm 12. He's like, I don't care.
So the hard drugs, how long did you continue using, and what were some of the other ones? Or
I was doing cocaine up until about 3 years ago. And my addiction began with like prescription narcotics. Like, I always had everything else under wraps. I could control it, I felt. And then I was in and out of the hospital a lot with kidney stones. And then they was realizing, after giving me two laser lipotripsies and putting stents in on two different occasions, that my kidney stone, which should have been shot down the size from the laser lipotripsy, was still the same. So they sent me to see a specialist. And after about 7-8 months of going from specialist to specialist that didn't accept my state insurance, they weren't from 5.4 millimeters to 22.8 millimeters. So my physician and the ER doctor signed off on it that whatever specialist I went to see, whether or not they accepted my insurance or not, had to accept me. And they sent me to Boston for a surgery. Robotically, they removed a mass that was on my right kidney. It wasn't a kidney stone. And through this whole year that went by, they were just feeding me Percocets left and right. This went on for about like 2 years. I was in and out the ER.
And how old?
Started in 2013. And they removed the mass in 2015. But they were just feeding me Percocets.
And you became addicted?
Not like, that's one thing that I don't understand. Like, when they give people a drug like that, like, if they would have just prescribed me Suboxone when they stopped me on it, it probably would have been a way better transition instead of just, all right, we're not giving you no more. Because then that turned to me buying prescription drugs in the street.
When you stopped getting the Percocet, when they stopped prescribing Percocet, you started
and like
buying on the street.
This was in a bad time because that's when they started all this fentanyl madness. The price was just so low that it was kind of like unbelievable. And I did half of one, woke up with seven EMTs inside my house.
So it was Percocet laced with fentanyl.
It looked like a Percocet, but it wasn't a Percocet.
And you, where were you living at this point?
Pawtucket, Rhode Island.
By then, you'd moved to Rhode Island.
Yeah, I'd been in Rhode Island for about the last 11 years.
Okay, so you woke up with EMTs in your house. You had overdosed.
Yep.
Did you go to Rhode Island Hospital or did you?
I went to Pawtucket Memorial Hospital.
What happened after that incident? Were you still taking drugs or?
Yeah, but I wanted to quit, but I just couldn't.
So like, you kept taking drugs?
I was addicted. Like, as much as I wanted to not do it, it was like I had to. Because with opiates, it's not like cocaine or marijuana, like it's all mental. Like with opiates, once you're on them, you need them. Like, I tried to get off 2-3 days and waking up sweating, my bones ache, my body aches, muscle aches. It's real bad when it comes to opiates.
Yeah, I've been told by other people that withdrawal is help and you go back.
Yep.
And that's, were you working during any of this period? Where were you working, Anthony?
I started off, I was working at Quad Graphics, and then I went from Quad Graphics working for a doctor's office, kind of, but it really wasn't the office itself. They have like a whole warehouse in Pawtucket, but we scheduled appointments for all the hospitals in New York. It was weird because like I lived right up the street, and when I would call my kid's mother, she'd be like, "Where the hell are you at?" Right down the street. She says, "Brooklyn, New York." I was like, "I can tell you I'm not in Brooklyn." But I worked there for about a year, and then I ended up working for Ashworth Awards, making medals for Boston Marathon, United States Figure Skating Team. And through all of this, I did it with a full-fledged addiction.
What happened when you decided you had to, one way or another, get off drugs?
My kids, really, because I've had a lot of people in my life that have been addicted to drugs their whole life. And during this fentanyl epidemic, like, I just, it was like every other week, somebody dead.
Someone you knew?
Yeah. Whether it was mom's lifelong friend, or my uncle's lifelong friend, or a friend of mine, a friend of my sister's, a family member. It just, it got to the point like where I didn't even go to services anymore.
So what did you do when you decided, did you come to Kodak or?
I tried doing it myself first.
You just cold turkey with
her? But it was just like, I was very unsuccessful.
Why? I mean, what was that like?
Because when you're waking up and you're trying to go to work, and like I said, that third day, you know, I'd make it through work, but then it's like as soon as I got out of work, I'm not even trying to go home. I'm trying to find somebody to go and get drugs off of. Because at that point in time, it's like, I'm not going to make it through the rest of the day. Even though work's over, I still got to go home and I got to deal with the kids. And I'm not going to make it through tomorrow.
So that's an incredibly powerful force at work. That, I guess, craving. Is craving the right word? Or?
Yes.
But you reached the point where you decided you had to. What did you do then? Who did you go to? Who did you see?
I was talking with people and they started telling me about the whole Suboxone and all of that. And I was like, so it really works? It was like, yeah, it really works. So I had set up, I was supposed to come to Kodak on like a Tuesday. And I still had to make it from Thursday all the way to Tuesday. And a friend of mine was like, well, you can buy the Suboxone in the street. So instead of going to buy Percocets, I bought Suboxone in the street. And I ended up going to my anger management session that I had to do for DCYF. And I got pulled over leaving the session. And the cop asked me, like, yo, is there anything in the car I need to know about? And I gave him a Suboxone willingly, told him about it, and I, you know, didn't think anything of it. I thought this was like a miracle thing. People like knew about it, and he still acted as if I had like hardcore drugs inside the car, and arrested me, pulled me out the car, ripped everything out through the car, and sat in jail.
How long were you in jail?
I was in jail from September until October.
So needless to say, you didn't make the Tuesday appointment?
No. But I was getting prescribed Suboxone by Monday morning.
So you got it at the ACI?
Yeah.
So that's really when the treatment began in the ACI. Okay. And so when you get out, you continued?
I continued. I followed through, went to meetings.
And it's worked?
And then sober houses.
Well, tell me, I mean, it's a great success. Talk to me about that.
Well, I just did everything I was supposed to do. You know, some people, they come into treatment and they tell you what to do. You got to follow the 12 steps. You got to get a sponsor. You got to change people, places, and things. And if you really want to work your recovery, that's exactly what you have to do. Pretty simple steps. And if you just don't do any of that, you're going to end up right back where you started at.
So you're still taking medication?
Yes.
So Linda, this might be a good time for you to just sort of jump in and talk about how MAT works, can work, and does work for many people.
Well, I guess the buprenorphine really worked for you, right?
Yes.
So depending upon the amount of brain change that happens when someone is using consistently, that amount of brain change actually indicates what medicine is going to work best for you, plus choice, you know. So the medicine, actually, the properly prescribed medicine is medicine that, you know, enters the body and goes to the brain and allows the centers in the brain to be satisfied so that withdrawal doesn't happen. Okay, so that's what happens when you take the Suboxone or the buprenorphine, and it does feel you're not sick anymore. And I think that, you know, when you have the right amount, you know, are you with 14?
24,
good. That makes sense. So at 24, you're not high. You know, it's not anything that causes euphoria. It just allows your brain to heal so that it's not fighting itself and trying to get what you need. Like if you said craving, that's the craving when the body gets used, when the brain gets used to having the extra opioids, like all those Percocets, or if somebody was using heroin, when the body gets used to that, it's a habit. It's called habituation, right? And so when the body doesn't get it, it reacts, and that's withdrawal. So if the right amount, it's called the therapeutic dose, you know, when you have the right amount, it's like you have life back.
Well, I'll take it when I get up in the morning. Around lunch break at work, I take another strip, and then I won't take my last dose after 6 o'clock, or I'm hell asleep. Mm. But
where are you living now?
I live in Cumberland, Rhode Island.
And are you working?
Yes.
Where are you working, or what type of work are you doing?
I work at Fuller Box right now. I started off there as a mechanic. I'm still a temp over there, but I haven't even been there for 4 months, and I went from mechanic to supervisor.
So talk about how this changed your life.
Not dependent on the drug no more. Like, every day, no matter what, it was like, get out of work, come see the kids, make sure they're all right, go hunt down the drugs. It didn't matter what the plans was for the evening. Especially if we had set plans and doing something and I couldn't get a hold of the drugs, can't tell you how many times I had my family at Olive Garden and I left them there while I'm hunting down drugs. Like, drugs, like, I'm a different type of addict, because, like, I've never sold stuff that belongs to my kids. I've never stole from my kids. I've never stole from anybody in my family. But there's some people that it's just so bad for them, like, selling their kids video game console, taking from their kids' trust funds. Like I've heard horror stories from friends of mine. And I'm just glad that, like, I stopped it before it got that far with me. My kids are everything to me.
So some people think that addiction is a moral failing or a character flaw or a choice and not what it is, which is a disease. Do you want to speak to that? And then I'd love if you would speak to that too. That's, I think, a very important point here.
It is a disease, but at the same time, you know, if you're a very strong-willed person, you can try your best to overcome it, but you can't do it without treatment. Whether it be METs or NA or AA, you need some sort of treatment.
Some type of intervention. So Linda, talk about that, the whole disease versus what some people think is, like, if you only just tried a little harder, you'd, you know.
Sure. The AMA said it's a chronic relapsing disease of the brain in 2011. Across the board, the medicine said. And it is. And it, you know, that it results often in lasting brain change. So when you take the medicine, the brain settles down a little bit and you start to develop new pathways in the brain to do what you used to do without the medicine. And that's the goal. The goal of medicine is to heal the brain. And so the goal of treatment is to facilitate and support and sustain the healing of your brain, right? So if it takes you 5 years or if it takes you 25 years, it doesn't matter. It's the same as taking your diabetes medicine or my blood pressure medicine. It's just, you know, this brain, this organ needs this medicine, just like the heart needs this medicine, pancreas needs this medicine. So it, when we look at it as a disease, then we can look at it as, okay, well, there's stuff we can prevent, there's ways we can intervene, there's ways we can treat, and, you know, there's recovery is possible. And I know, you know, that's such an overused phrase, but look at you, you know, your story is the reason that I'm doing this 33 years later.
My new drug of choice is helping people. That's the best hobby.
Yeah, it's so...
especially when you see people that stick with it, you know, that's the best hobby.
It really
is. It's like watching my kids grow up.
So some people eventually will go off medication, correct?
Some will.
And some may just have to be on for years.
Yeah.
Whatever, you drew an analogy to other diseases.
You know, it's simply a disease, and we have always been, as a society, remarkably critical of diseases of the brain. For some reason, a disease of the brain is something that we should manage on our own, and, you know, the whole thing about stoicism and all of this, you know, and it's simply a disease. So there's a choice to use in the beginning, somewhere along the line, and when it's medication for pain, it's a choice anybody would make, most people would make. Other times people use it recreationally. And then there's just one day that it's not a choice anymore. And that's when the disease begins.
And there was a point in my recovery where my MATs wasn't also just for substance abuse. It was also for pain. Because I had gotten stabbed, like, within the first year of my recovery.
That's what that scar is?
Yep. And as soon as I was in the ambulance, they was asking me my pain level, and I was like, listen, pain level doesn't even matter. When I get to the hospital, don't let them give me anything. I got what I need right here. I was like, I came with my medication. I don't need nothing else.
So I think my last question, John, for you is, what advice would you give people who are still in the circumstances you were before you decided to recover?
Don't give up. They say in LA, hey, you pay attention to everything in NA. Like, everything's already there. People have already been through this. They documented all this. And that's what we read about all the time. And they say it so many times, you know, it works if you work it. Mm. If you come into this half-hearted and, you know, you expect to reap all the benefits and not put in any of the work, it's not going to happen. You can't go to a job site and expect the house to build itself. It just doesn't work like that. You have to actually put in the work. You know, it's 10% inspiration and 90% perspiration. You got to put in the sweat.
Counseling was important to you, too.
Yep.
And I think that's an important part of the story.
It definitely is light at the end of the tunnel. There was times where I didn't see it. And I've had so many people tell me, you know, after the storm, the sun always returns, and I'm living proof of that.